jamming. Welcome back. And I hope you said welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting worldwide. And it is my esteemed pleasure to welcome now the, what are you, David? Are you the director of KiwiBlog? It's David Farah. Ladies and gentlemen, from KiwiBlog, I'd like to welcome him to the show now. David, are you there?
Yeah, g'day. And it's great when you're a one-man band because you can call yourself what you like. You can be the owner, the editor, the managing director.
Yeah.
Normally I go with editor.
Yeah, editor. Okay, that sounds really nice. And we're just going to stop the Skype text chat going on there because we can hear it coming through. But the interesting thing that I find about KiwiBlog is that it really is incredibly popular. Kiwis absolutely love it. And what I find interesting is that it is such a diverse blog that really does incorporate so many others into the fold. And I'm curious, David, if you could just kind of explain who you are, just for the listeners and those who are unfamiliar with KiwiBlog and unfamiliar with yourself, you know, where you came from and conversely, KiwiBlog.
Sure. With KiwiBlog, I set up in 2003 and my motto is I actually write on anything I'm interested in. Now, most people come to it for the politics because I think a lot of people like to debate politics. But I actually also talk about my overseas travels. I'll do play reviews. I try to put quite a bit of humour up there, etc. Talk about crappy airlines. And I think people actually really like the fact that it's not just politics, because there's more to life than politics. My background, though, is I worked in the Parliament for around 8 years, so I know a bit about the place. I worked for 4 National Party prime ministers or opposition leaders, and it was towards the end of my time in Parliament that I actually got into blogging. I started reading other blogs and thought, hey, it'd be quite cool to be able to do my own blog, mainly just because I like to have my say on things. The other thing I tend to cover a bit is sort of internet issues. I've been on the board of the Internet Society here for around 10 years. And from my point of view, I just actually love the internet and want to stop politicians interfering in it. So that's been what sort of drives the internet side of things, is to keep it free and open for the globe and to stop governments getting their hands on it.
Trying to stop the government from getting their hands on what, sorry?
On the internet. We've seen, you know, in Egypt recently, they closed the internet down to try and stop people communicating during the protests. You have Disney and the Hollywood studios try to get governments to pass laws, kicking people off the internet if you download a song. There's constant threats to what we like to think of as the freedom of the internet. So that's part of what drives me too, is actually being involved there and trying to keep the internet out of the control of governments.
Well, yeah, I man after my own heart, because let's face it, when it comes to freedom of speech, the biggest threat that you'll ever face is your own government.
Well, the only bigger threat is all the governments of the world combined. And, you know, there's actually stuff happening at a global level where UN bodies are saying perhaps we should run the internet. We perhaps should have a rule that says you can't register a domain name if it offends a particular religion or a particular country. So most people don't see this, but there is actually a battle going on about, does the internet stay pretty much run the way it has for 20 years, where as long as it doesn't bust anything, you can do what you like on it? Or is it something where governments get more and more say over not just what's acceptable within their own country, because that's fair enough, you have to obey the laws of your country. But as a New Zealander, I don't want the government of Egypt or the government of the United States, for that matter, telling me what I can do on the internet in New Zealand.
Well, we wouldn't want anybody really telling us what to do. I mean, it's the funny thing, don't you think, David, is that when politicians or people in positions of power campaign on the platform of freedom, the system seems to have lost what freedom really means. And I'm interested to know, what does freedom actually mean to you?
To me, it means the maximum ability to just make your own decisions without needing to get permission from the government. And that, for me, there's two parts to it. There's what we call economic freedom, and I see that as a low-tax economy with regulation as minimal as possible, but also what I call social freedoms, where I'm far from convinced that some of the things we do criminalization of cannabis users, etc., is something we should be spending a lot of time and money on. So I very much fall in what people call the classical liberal, not quite libertarian, but, you know, if the state's going to be involved in something, there should be a really good reason for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it should be like we're being invaded. The government has to intervene, right? You know, there's a clear life and death scenario there. Yeah. But this is the thing. Governments only seem to be useful when it comes to disaster and catastrophe. And I find more and more that the legislation that governments pass actually makes disaster and catastrophe in terms of social policy and all of that far more common. And so the government essentially creates these excuses for itself to come into our lives.
Well, sadly, governments do always get bigger, and we've had a big disaster in Christchurch with the earthquake, and what the government and parliament have done is said, oh, you need to be able to rebuild, so we'll give you an exemption from all these laws. And that's good, that's the right thing to do, but you sort of then think, wouldn't it be nice perhaps if we had a few less of these laws, even when there isn't an earthquake to recover from? The problem is the society's got so complicated today that you can't be as pure as you would like to be. If I give an example, I don't think there should be a law forcing you to wear a bicycle helmet if you want to go cycling. Likewise, I don't think there should be a law forcing you to put a seatbelt on in a car. If you want to be stupid and risk your health, that's a decision for you. But we've got a public health system, though, that we all fund. So then me as a taxpayer, if I have to pay the recovery bills and pay for someone to be on welfare for the next 40 years if they injure themselves in a car crash, the challenge is how do I then reconcile that libertarian principle of people should be able to free to choose what they do with the reality that if they choose dumb things, our current system of government means I pay for it.
Oh, you mean what, like personal responsibility? You know, somebody has to actually have common sense when they go about their daily life. What an effing revolutionary idea, David. You're a conspiracy theorist. You're crazy. You know, this is the kind of word association that we kind of have to deal with now. If you talk about anything that's real or anything that would truly change the ground upon which our society is built to something that perhaps, in the case of Christchurch, isn't sand, you get demonized.
Yeah, well, people misunderstand so often what it's like, partly because we don't really know how important stuff like freedom is until you haven't had it. And I spend quite a bit of time travelling around Europe. I'm involved with a group called the International Democrat Union and the International Young Democrat Union, which is sort of the centre-right parties from various countries. And when you talk to the Eastern Europeans, they lived through not having freedom. And that's actually turned them into some of the best and most passionate supporters of free enterprise, free state, free country, etc., because they know what happens when governments get too powerful.
Yeah, well, maybe we need some kind of a fascist dictator to take over and destroy our country before people will, you know, have the idea that, hey, participating in politics and telling our politicians what we want on a daily basis is the price that we pay to prevent those kind of things from happening again. But at the moment, I think we're on the slow boil. You know, it's just gradually ratcheting up day by day, year by year, to a tyranny that we will eventually overthrow, in my opinion. But the problem is getting people to realize that what's coming at the moment, before it happens, is about as important as whether or not it's happening at all.
There's a bit of a cycle here, and we almost did have. He was a dictator because it was elected, but we had Prime Minister Muldoon, and under his government, things were, I wouldn't use the word fascist because that's got a particular connotation, but you had a price freeze, a wage freeze, a rent freeze. The government told you how much you sell things for, how much to pay your staff, what the interest rate would be. You needed a prescription if you wanted butter instead of margarine, or margarine instead of butter. You needed the Reserve Bank's permission to take more than $1,000 out of the country. So we have this incredibly controlled economy in every instance. Like, you weren't allowed to import what you wanted. Only one person could manufacture shopping trolleys, and they did well. And we then had almost a revolution where the government reacted to such a controlled economy that it threw off the shackles. And that was the great sort of reforming government from 84 to 90, where they actually did a lot of good things, where they got rid of these restrictions. But then, you know, some people didn't like what happened. You get change of government, and then they start to pop them back on because people forget what it was like in the bad old days. I think you're right. There comes a point, and we saw a bit of it at the last election even, where you had government departments start to say, we've decided that we're going to set a maximum pressure that your shower can be, because otherwise you may use too much water, and that uses electricity. Never mind you're willing to pay for it. So there was a bit of a backlash at the last election, but inevitably, even the current government, you know, is still very heavily in all of our lives.
Yeah, well, and this just begs the question about why people choose to vote either blue or red when they're both clearly purple.
Well, it is shade, but for most people, they're just focused on not philosophy, not on what they want the country to be, but on pre-hip pocket issues about, is this going to be make life easier for me or better for me? And it's only those who should take the time to think about it who then approach things from a sort of philosophical point of view, where they say, look at all the evidence over 40, 50 years. Countries with smaller states have inevitably done better economically. They've had higher growth, they've had higher incomes, etc., because they don't tax people too much money, they don't interfere too much in their lives. But most people are just worried, you know, about hip pocket issues, so that's why they tend to go between a centre-left party and a centre-right party, where there's only quite moderate changes. If you really want a sort of liberty government, my belief is you almost need to start it from scratch. And I know in the United States, they talked about setting up a free state project to try and have all the libertarians move to a particular state. And there actually was an attempt, this is quite interesting, in the 1970s, where they tried to set up a libertarian state in an island off Tonga. And that would have been a great experiment to see how successful a state that adheres to some principles of freedom could have done. But sadly, the Tongan Navy, I don't think there was much of a navy in Tonga.
A couple of dugout canoes. Dugout canoes and 9mm pistols. Go ahead.
Was enough to do the job, and they had to move to the islands.
It's because they're libertarians. They don't believe in stopping anybody from their freedom. You know, it's your freedom to invade me, your freedom to shoot me. That reminds me of, you remember the Mount Albert by-election, right? The legalized cannabis party made a complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority that none of the minor parties got any coverage whatsoever during that election campaign. In fact, me personally, I was the only person to take footage of any minor candidates the whole by-election. Yeah. And what I thought would be a good idea is if I tried to, you know, contact all these minor parties and say, hey, look, the legalized cannabis party is making this complaint. Maybe you should voice your concerns too. And the reply I got from the libertarians was, well, you know, we want to ensure freedom of the press by not complaining about the press not giving us any coverage.
I know it's a dilemma. Do you use the tools you don't believe in, like a government complaints process? Are you sort of giving them to the enemy almost?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. It's like resistance, in my opinion, to anything is one of the most important concepts any political party really does need to, take on board, is that not only are you supposed to be promoting things that work, but you're also supposed to be opposing things that don't work or don't do any good for the country. Or at least that's my opinion, is that you kind of have to subscribe to some kind of dichotomy with what's good and what's wrong and address both of them equally in order to run any kind of balanced government that works.
So,
but I could be wrong.
Use their tools against them to show how bad they are. An example of this is the last government passed a law called the Electoral Finance Act. And it was an awful law because it went and interfered with your most basic freedoms of the right to criticise politicians during election year by spending money criticising them. And you had to... And what I did is it was such a bad law, I actually did complain about a couple of advertisements just to make the point, this is such a bad law. And one of them was a TUI billboard. And it was a great TUI billboard. It was basically when Winston says no, he means no, taking the piss out of the fact that he'd been caught lying during the campaign. And I was sort of hoping that if I'd won with my complaint against the TUI billboard, that it would show people how bad the law is. But there was a part of me that felt, oh, my God, I love TUI billboards. I hope I don't become hated because I've complained against a TUI billboard. Of course, what we should have is a law where...
Oh, well, we'll get back into this after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, my marvellous and special and various other nice adjectives guest is David Farah from kiwiblog.co.nz, one of the most highly followed blogs in the country. I believe it's 92 overall the websites in New Zealand. And we'll be right back after the break. Getting darker. Oh, in the southern hemisphere, we're entering into winter. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the fabulous Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fluoridated capital with private water supplies, Auckland, New Zealand, the super city of Agenda 21 and government takeover and total dictatorship. And then the population just loves it, don't they? But they go, oh, well, we'll get Len Brown. He's not as high a degree Freemason as John Banks. He'll run the city much better. Yeah, great. Welcome back also to my remarkably special guest, David Farah from kiwiblog.co.nz. I believe you're New Zealand's number one blog, aren't you now, David?
Yeah, it's, there is a blog run by a Kiwi called Read Write Web, which is certainly, it's a global blog, it's a tech blog, and gets huge readership. But in terms of blogs that are about New Zealand, mine's number one by some margin. Around 80,000 people read it, from what we can tell. In a month, we get around 600,000 page views.
It's pretty fabulous, man. Says here you've got 471 sites linking in.
Oh, okay, you must be on Technorati.
Yeah. And Alexa.com as well says you're 73,969 for all New Zealanders, which is kind of like the world rank, I think, which is in the top 100,000 websites in the world, which is not an easy feat, let alone from New Zealand. You know,
it's been quite remarkable, the growth in numbers over the years. But when I started it, I thought there'd be 100, 200 people reading it. But it seems to become a bit of the sort of debate central. I've had around 650,000 comments made over the years. So a lot of people come there to see the right and the left and other people have a big debate. And I get a lot of comment from Kiwis who are travelling overseas or live overseas that it's sort of the place they sort of just check in to see what's happening on the day. They use it as a sort of launching pad to then go to other blogs.
Well, yeah, and this is the thing, you've sort of networked everybody in there, and thank you also for adding Guerrilla Media to that list as well. It seems that in political discourse and news, the mainstream media is very, very lacking, and just recently an article's come out saying that MediaWorks can't afford to pay the 43 million buckaroonies for their licensing. So it's very obvious to me that mainstream media is basically starting to, they started to lose listenership and lose the public giving a flying F about them quite some time ago. And they're basically, we're just going through the motions here. You know, eventually the media as a structure will completely change. We've now got digital broadcast television and the internet providing the direct antithesis to all this regular broadcasting. The problem is that the government and large corporates like major media companies as well are lobbying to try and restrict the freedoms that people enjoy on the internet. And in my opinion, it seems that they're basically anti-competitive slime trash that are just trying to F everybody else over.
Yeah, well,
maybe that's a bit harsh.
It is a bit harsh, but it's very tough for them to be in an industry which is disappearing to a degree and changing. In the United States, the newspapers used to make billions of dollars off classified advertising. Craigslist came along, did it for free, wiped out classified advertising in most newspapers. And again, in New Zealand, you're seeing people say, I don't buy the daily newspaper anymore, but I read what I want to online. And we've just seen a major news agency, the Press Association, has said it's going to close down. And we've learned that one of the rules they had was that Fairfax, which is the major newspaper owner, had said, we don't want you doing articles more than 500 words, because they cost too much. So I'm looking at this thinking, well, blogs don't have 500-word limits. So if you put 500-word limits on what you can get from a news agency, people are going to turn to the area where they can get longer and better analysis.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's a reduction of costs, you know. Like, if you want to print a newspaper, you have to have some means of manufacturing, printing. All that costs an awful amount of money, whereas you could post 100 articles online, wouldn't cost you a cent.
Yeah. And you know? Anyone can be a publisher. And it might be that one individual blog site won't be as good as the collection of talents you might get in a newspaper, where there's a law reporter, a politics reporter, an economics reporter. But if you go to different blog sites, there's half a dozen economists blogging in New Zealand who provide superb insights into economic issues. There's superb sites dedicated to scrutinizing what happens on TV. There's political sites. So what I like about blogging is that you can get such high-quality stuff if you know where to look at. In the United States, the best place to go if you're interested in the Supreme Court is the SCOTUS blog. Within 6 hours of a major court decision coming out, you've got 6 to 8 blog posts by different professors or other people saying this is what it means, this is, you know, the implications. So I think there is a real trend away from general reporting in newspapers to going to what I call specialist blog sites where someone's regarded as an expert in that area. So let's follow them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that with alternative media sort of rising in somewhat of a meteoric fashion, and I think you'd probably have to be living under a rock to be able to deny that happening, we also have, like I say, the amalgamation of mainstream media outlets, like as my producer put here, in the USA, after the Telecommunications Act was passed, it went from 83 media companies, and now there are only 4. So I think what's really happening is that people are losing their choice. And it's interesting, the point that you brought up there is because of the fact that, you know, the mainstream media is very restricted and they censor a whole lot of things that they cannot say. People nowadays, they have an alternative, right? It was only back in the day when there was no internet, when you practically had to go, I don't know, get carbon copies out of frickin' Moscow or something like that of information that the government didn't want you to have. And now you can do it at home all the time, just like you do with your television, except it doesn't run to a time clock. Your computer runs by your clock. Whenever you've turned it on, the clock's running.
Exactly. You know? And the same's happening on television. We used to talk about I watch TV1 or TV3, but for those of us who now have My Sky boxes or overseas their TiVo boxes, I don't even know what channel I watch. I just look for programs I like, set them for series record, watch them whenever I like. So the concept of what channel it was on has become meaningless for me. And the next step is, of course, even if it's not on any of the channels that you can get through Sky, if I read of a good program in the United States or the UK, and I can't get on my New Zealand television, I go and get a copy of it online. Because I don't want to wait, you know, 6 months for someone to decide we're going to show this TV series in New Zealand, or they might decide never to show it here. And eventually I think what you're going to have is sort of TVs linked to the internet where you can choose to listen to any program you want. You can tune it to any radio station you want. Already you've actually got car radios are being changed from traditional AM, FM car radios to internet car radios. So you can actually throw a wireless internet signal to your car, listen to your favorite internet radio station. And that's absolutely where the future is going to be, that everything's going to go by the internet, not via these old broadcast frequencies.
You know, I think you're right, and this drifts back to my point originally. Our Lord and Saviour, Barack H. O'Barry, has passed a law by executive fiat, of course, giving himself an internet kill switch. If there's any emergency anywhere in the world that affects economy, environment, or any of that kind of stuff, he can literally shut down the internet, just like Mubarak was able to do in Egypt. So my thoughts are that because alternative media is rising, and I think in a lot of ways, criticism of governments and the critical analysis of the tyranny rising from government, more to the point, they are now scrambling to shut it down so that this kind of weapon that's being used by the people against their, in my opinion, self-serving Basically, the governments we've got are pretty much inappropriate for the world that we live in. You know, they're looking backwards and not looking forwards. Yeah, and they don't like being criticised. But go ahead. Sorry.
Close down the internet because sure, the US government could close down the US part of the internet, but this is something that was designed to withhold nuclear attack. That would mean a lot of sites were unavailable, but the rest of the world would still have their internet, still be able to connect to each other. It might be a bit slower. And this is, of course, the big threat. And, you know, the Chinese government, we believe, you know, is training out cyber armies to try and disable the internet as a means of attack. So it is a threat to some governments, but because of the global nature of it, I'm actually a huge believer that, you know, it's not going to succumb.
Well, you know, and I think it's because of the fact that people are just so fed up with mainstream media and turning to the internet. I think you might actually be right, is that they wouldn't be able to get away with any wholesale censorship. I believe last year they tried to censor a number of conspiracy theory websites from the United States here in New Zealand, and Slingshot and Orcon, I believe, were the only ones to refuse to censor the internet, which is why I incidentally am now with Orcon. And the rest of them, who did censor these websites, got a plethora of emails saying, "Why the heck are they censoring it?" and all this anger. I'm gonna quit this crappy internet company. And then they uncensored them again, you know. And I think that is a really, really good sign. Is that the idea of democracy, or rather direct participation of the like, is now on the rise again? Because I think maybe everybody's been sort of apathetic, and that's why political campaigns, I believe, make me so angry a lot of the time, especially during election year, because I don't know if you agree with this sentiment, David, but when you listen to a politician say a speech to, say, a public meeting, it feels really dry. It feels like it's been repeated 1,000 times. It feels like they don't really believe it.
Oh, and it is. It's a, you know, they call it a stump speech. And they make the same one hundreds and hundreds of times. And what annoys me often about those speeches too is all the promises they make as if they're paying for them. They're not. We're paying for them. You know, it's very easy to be generous with other people's money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and it's also very easy nowadays to get generous donations as well. For your political campaign.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to push a particular corporate agenda.
Yeah, well, of course, we've got the US presidential election starting to warm up, and I've been amazed just seeing in the last couple of days that Donald Trump has, you know, become the second most favoured Republican candidate. And some people have been talking that you may have a Trump-Palin ticket. Or a Palin-Trump ticket, which will stir up the establishment, if true.
It's like, oh, my goodness, The Apprentice and The Model. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Check us out on GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's alternative media. My somewhat fabulous and remarkably special guest is David Farah from KiwiBlog.co.nz. We'll be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
Around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing.
And we're back. We're back, ladies and gentlemen. Change comes whether or not you like it. And the new campaign slogan for Barack H. O'Barry's 2012 election, as change you can beg for. Now, my very special guest is David Farah from KiwiBlog, and I've asked him to divulge his thoughts on the biggest stories that are hitting New Zealand today. David, carry us away.
Yeah, the biggest one would probably be what they call the Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Act. And it sounds quite innocuous, but this is a law that allows the government to pretty much change any other law in New Zealand if they think it's needed to help rebuild Christchurch after the earthquake. So it's one of those quite interesting ones because no one wants you to have to spend 6 months filling in forms before you can rebuild your house. So people generally support the law, but it is giving the government a lot of power. They can also, ultimately, someone in government, and it's probably the minister, may make decisions such as this suburb, too many houses can't be rebuilt, we're just going to flatten the suburb and build a new one. So there's a lot of people quite worried about the law. Does it have that right mixture of speed, but also accountability? And they're having hearings on it this week. So I think that's what most of the story will be on. The other story, it's not so important, but you know, makes good headlines, has been the Labour Party did their list ranking. And one of their West Coast Conservative MPs have spoke out against it, saying that you don't have any chance on the list unless you're in the union or you're gay. And that sort of resulted in several days of publicity and people working out, you know, is this true and there is a degree of truth to it, etc. He used the term a gaggle of gays, which I think has now entered the political lexicon as a new term.
Well, you know, and this kind of makes me think, you know, the conspiracy theorist in me likes to think that, hey, maybe the Labour Party is basically being set up and taken down early on in the piece so that they've got virtually no chance of winning this election. And in my opinion, they got no chance anyway. They're just kind of putting the nails in the coffins here.
Well, they are, but it's not by their enemies, it's by themselves.
Yeah.
Every time that they try to start talking about jobs, the economy, things that people might want to listen to them on, they go and have one of their MPs do something stupid, or they cover up a sex scandal, or for the last 2 or 3 months, all they've been doing is actually defending themselves, talking about themselves, and they're running out of time. The election is only 6 months away. It'd be great for people to be able to claim it's some evil conspiracy by the vast right-wing conspiracy, you know, led by just many, but it's just own goal after own goal.
Oh, man, it would just be so juicy if that was the case, though. Now, I was wondering, I think that I've met a lot of politicians, and I'm sure you have too, and they all get up to kind of stuff like this to a large extent, but very, very few of you know, the negative exploits of politicians wind up making it into the major news media, basically because they're good at covering their tracks in a lot of ways. And the other question is, if they are, you know, kind of all engaged in the same sort of hobnobbery-do as you do in Parliament, it seems to be disproportionately screwing over the Labour Party, which I'm all in favour of. I'm not sure if this election is going to really hold any weight for one side or the other. I believe that John Key's government is going to be re-elected, quite possibly with an increased majority. And then they'll go on to sell off our state assets, as they promised they will. And goodness knows what else. I remember when they were elected the first time and they said, well, basically, you know, we're just going to give you tax cuts and everything else that Labor already promised. And then, oh, sorry, we have to do that.
Yeah, they're being a bit bolder with their policies for the second term. I think the first term for the National Government was about trust, about saying you can trust us that we'll only do what we promise, and we're not going to go off and do stuff that we don't have a mandate for. And for the upcoming election, they're saying there's some stuff we didn't do last term, but we do now want to change. We do want to sell off minority stakes and some assets. We do want to stop having working for families go to well-off families who don't need it. And, you know, they'll campaign on that in the election. At the end, though, I'm not sure, like you, it's going to be an election much about policy. I think it will mainly be about leadership. I think people say, I trust John Key, I like him, I don't like everything he does, but I think he's a decent guy trying to do the best for New Zealand. And it's not that they dislike Phil Goff, but they just don't know enough about him to think, do I want to make him Prime Minister instead of John Key? All they really know is he's been in Parliament for 30 years, and he started off as a communist almost. Then he became one of the most rabid right-wingers under the Rogernomics Revolution. And then he became a staunch social democrat under Helen Clark. And now he's a bit of who knows what he stands for.
Yeah. And so basically, he's been flip-flopping the whole political career, and you don't know what he's going to be doing next. But John Key's always been making money and getting other people monstrously in debt through banking interests, so he hasn't changed his tune one bit. I'd like to thank you, David, for coming on the show with us today. An absolute pleasure, my friend. Hope to have you on again sometime.
Same for me. All the best.
All right. There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. David Farah from Kiwi Blog. We'll be back next segment.
Frontline, log on, tune in, stand and be counted. Wounded stations in the belly of the vulture. Watch your back, there's no civilians, women, children. Frontline, listen, consider this a distant early warning. The fire's imminent, pollution, gathering dust particles, funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.